Tonight, another man killed by police, this time during a traffic stop in Minnesota. The victim's fiance streaming the grim aftermath live on social media. She says he was following the officer's orders. This on the heels of that other deadly shooting in Louisiana. New details about the moments leading up to it as nationwide outrage grows. Under oath, the FBI chief on the hot seat defending the call to not charge Hillary Clinton over her emails. Trump's tense moments with GOP senators, anger erupting behind closed doors. Bridge tragedy, a child killed in a car by rubble falling from an overpass struck by a truck. And cancer warning, an alarming rise in forms doctors say are easily preventable by a childhood vaccine. So why aren't more children getting it? Nightly News begins right now.
From NBC News World Headquarters in New York, this is NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt.
Good evening. For a second day in a row, we have been confronted by graphic images of a man dying after being shot by police under questionable circumstances. The latest was streamed live over Facebook. It showed a bloody scene inside a car, and it was calmly narrated by the fiancé of the driver just after he was shot by an officer during a traffic stop near St. Paul, Minnesota. President Obama spoke this evening about the shootings.
There's a big chunk of our fellow citizenry that feels as if, because of the color of their skin, they are not being treated the same.
While official answers have been slow to come in this shooting, tonight we have pieced together critical details. NBC's Blake McCoy has the latest.
Stay with me.
Moments after Philando Castile is shot multiple times by police.
He's covered. He killed my boyfriend.
His fiance, Diamond Reynolds, hits record, broadcasting live to Facebook.
Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot four bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
We don't know what happened in the moments before the recording, but Reynolds says they were pulled over around 9 o'clock Wednesday night for a broken taillight. Her four-year-old in the back seat.
Keep him up!
Where's my daughter? You got my daughter?
He lets the officer know, officer, I have a firearm on me. I begin to yell, but he's licensed to carry. After that, he began to take off shots. But, don't move, don't move.
She then says 15 minutes go by with no medical attention. Castile is declared dead at 9:37 p.m.
I wanted everybody in the world to see what the police do.
Falcon Heights, Minnesota is a small, safe, predominantly white suburb of the Twin Cities. While little is known about the officer who fired, protesters have taken to the governor's mansion demanding action.
It really bothers me that we have to talk about how he was a good man and how he didn't have a criminal record. I don't give a damn. He didn't deserve to die.
The governor went a step further.
Would this have happened if those passengers, the driver and the passenger were white? I don't think it would have.
Castile, who managed the cafeteria of a local elementary school, is described by coworkers as quiet, respectful, and kind. His sister watched on Facebook as he took his last breath.
I'm watching him.
Watching him fight for his life.
And I'm trying to tell her to go faster. I'm trying to get there. I couldn't get there.
The officer is on paid leave tonight and will be identified once investigators finish questioning him. There are calls for the Justice Department to step in. Right now, they say they are monitoring the situation and will assist if necessary. Lester?
A difficult story on so many levels. Blake, thank you. The deadly incident in Minnesota comes amid the growing outrage over another fatal police shooting caught on tape in Louisiana. Tonight, we're learning more about the officers involved in that shooting and the final moments leading up to it. Let's get more from NBC's Gabe Gutierrez.
With the Justice Department now leading the investigation into the shooting, authorities are poring over surveillance video from the convenience store where Alton Sterling died and body cameras that police say were dislodged during the scuffle.
We want to make sure that this investigation is broad as possible.
A homeless man who claims to be the initial 911 caller tells NBC News Sterling showed him a gun in his pocket.
He pulled a gun on a complainant and told him he couldn't be around there.
What remains unclear is what escalated the confrontation with police so quickly before cell phones started recording. Today, we learn more about the officers involved, Blaine Salamone and Howie Lake. According to service records obtained by NBC News, they had five complaints between them, three for use of force. But each time, they were cleared by the Internal Affairs Division. Sterling often felt harassed by the police, says his cousin, Sherida.
I have no reason why the police felt threatened by Alton, but his body size and the color of his skin. And this is not the first time they've harassed him.
Sterling had a lengthy criminal history. Back in 2009, a police affidavit says an officer tried to pat Sterling down when he resisted arrest and ended up wrestling with the defendant on the ground when a black semi-auto gun fell from his waistband.
What does his arrest record from years ago have to do with what happened?
Now representing some of his relatives is Chris Stewart, no stranger to controversial police shootings. He also represented the family of Walter Scott, who was killed in West Charleston, South Carolina last year.
This has been happening, especially to African Americans in this country. I think that people are just seeing it now because everybody's got a cell phone.
Here outside the convenience store where Sterling died, a memorial is growing. For two nights now, demonstrators have been passionate but peaceful. Authorities here hope that trend continues tonight. Lester.
All right, Gabe, thank you. And let's take a step back here. This issue of police shootings of black men was pushed into the national consciousness after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, almost 2 years ago. The grand jury, as you may recall, declined to indict the officer in that case. Nonetheless, it sparked a movement and a closer examination of the roots of such confrontations. Kristen Welker takes a look.
This week's police-involved shootings caught on camera, again sparking national outrage, even spilling over into today's Capitol Hill hearings.
We cannot allow black men to continue to be slaughtered. This morning, I woke up to my wife literally crying.
It's been 2 years since Michael Brown, a black teenager, was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, prompting protests all across the country. But on the streets of Ferguson today, residents say not enough has changed.
It's not Ferguson. It's the entire country.
According to an analysis conducted by the Washington Post, the number of fatal shootings by officers has actually increased from 465 in the first 6 months of last year to 491 already this year. Blacks shot at 2.5 times the rate of whites. The root causes are complicated.
It's a combination of what I think is not the best policing. I think it's also race is absolutely a dynamic.
They misinterpret the threat level. They misinterpret what's happening. And they often go to their firearms when they don't need to.
But there have been some noticeable changes. Hundreds of police departments improving training. Thousands equipping officers with body cameras.
People have to understand that body cameras are not a panacea. It's just one tool. It's just another tool in the tool belt to use to enhance that trust, that accountability.
But perhaps the biggest frustration is still occurring inside families, where African-American parents are teaching hard lessons.
So if you want to live and wake up the next day, just do what they say. Even though they're violating your rights.
Lessons, they say, are critical in hopes of preventing tragedies like the ones captured this week. Kristen Welker, NBC News, Washington.
Let's turn now to the tense showdown on Capitol Hill today. FBI Director James Comey on the hot seat before Congress, defending the decision not to charge Hillary Clinton for using private email when she was Secretary of State. NBC's Peter Alexander tells us it sparked very heated exchanges with Republicans demanding answers.
Classified information is...
The grilling began almost immediately.
That's not a crime. That's outrageous.
House Republicans demanding to know why FBI Director James Comey didn't recommend criminal charges against Hillary Clinton, despite calling her handling of classified information extremely careless. Comey didn't back down on some of his harshest criticism of Clinton.
Secretary Clinton said there was nothing marked classified on her emails either sent or received. Was that true?
That's not true.
Still, he strongly defended his decision, saying there was no criminal intent and that the law in question had been used in just one prosecution.
No reasonable prosecutor would bring the second case in 100 years focused on gross negligence.
Donald Trump this week suggesting a crooked deal.
Rigged system, folks.
Comey saying the decision was his alone.
Nobody outside the FBI family had any idea what I was about to say. I say that under oath.
Also revealed today that three emails of the thousands on Clinton's server were marked with a small C, meaning classified, but contained no classified header at the top.
I think it's possible that she didn't understand what a C meant when she saw it in the body of an email like that.
Republicans aren't buying it.
I don't think that our investigation established that she was actually particularly sophisticated with respect to classified information.
As we can tell, isn't she an original classification authority, though?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Good grief.
Democrats dismissing it all as a political witch hunt.
Republicans have turned on you with a vengeance.
But tonight, the Republican chairman says he'll ask Comey to review whether Clinton lied to Congress about her emails.
If anybody else had done this, they'd probably be in handcuffs.
Comey stood his ground and basically said Hillary Clinton did a really bad, irresponsible thing, but there's no legal basis to indict her, and Republicans didn't shake him off of that.
Director Comey said if Hillary Clinton worked for him, she could be reprimanded or even fired. Still tonight, Clinton's team says that Comey knocked down false Republican talking points and said any effort to try to keep this email issue alive will backfire. Lester?
Peter Alexander on Capitol Hill, thank you. Just 11 days before the Republican National Convention, Donald Trump was still trying to find common ground today with Republicans in Washington. Many of them remain highly skeptical of his candidacy. The talk was tough, and our Hallie Jackson has more.
Striding into town, Donald Trump's swagger tripped up by a testy meeting today with dozens of senators, some skeptical, like Jeff Flake, introducing himself confrontationally as the senator from Arizona who wasn't captured. A reference to Trump's dig at former prisoner of war John McCain.
What an awful, awful thing to say about a war hero. I thought that he needed to hear it from maybe the other senator from Arizona.
While Trump appeared to get a strong reception from many of the 215 House Republicans he saw, he's still struggling to unite others. Never Trump leader Ben Sasse still unconvinced, even after his surprise stop to visit Trump.
Happy to listen.
Republican sources tell NBC News Trump singled out Sasse twice, at least, trying to win him over. Better luck with Ted Cruz, though.
There was no discussion of any endorsement. He asked me if I would speak at the convention, and I said I'd be very glad to do so.
Can he say a message?
Nobody hammered Hillary Clinton more effectively than he did.
And that's what many holdouts want to see, Trump on message, instead of going off like he did Wednesday night, defending a now-deleted tweet, which some found anti-Semitic, showing a Jewish Star of David over $100 bills.
So you have the star, which is fine. You shouldn't have taken it down.
That contradicts what his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, suggested, defending Trump in an op-ed, but calling the tweet careless.
Trump is good at commanding free media attention, but most of the time it hurts him more than it helps him. That's why Republicans are now so incredibly nervous. We've never had a situation where we're right on top of the convention and our nominee is in a cold war with his own party.
Trump's team pushing back against any suggestion today's meetings were anything but positive, calling them substantive, claiming members were in total agreement. Many here in Washington speculating about who Trump may pick as his running mate. Chris Christie on that list. And late tonight, NBC News has learned Christie will travel with Trump tomorrow to the battleground of Florida. Lester?
All right. Hallie Jackson in Washington. Thanks, Hallie. A terrifying tragedy on a Texas highway today. Debris from a bridge damaged after a garbage truck rammed into it, fell onto a car traveling below. Inside, a mother and her two young children, one died. As our Tom Costello explains, it's a much more common risk on the road than you may have realized.
Underneath that rubble in Sealy, Texas, a car crushed by falling concrete from the bridge above. 12-year-old Breen Bollock, riding in the front seat, was killed. Her mother, Leah Bollock, rushed to an area hospital. Another 9-year-old managed to climb out with minor injuries. Police say a 72-year-old garbage truck driver had driven under the bridge without retracting the dumpster boom.
If his boom would have been down, he would have been okay.
Nationwide, trucks hit bridges hundreds of times a year. Over a three-year period, 100 strikes in Illinois, 195 in Florida, 400 in Texas. In New York State, roughly 200 bridge strikes each year. 80% of them blamed on drivers using consumer GPS devices that don't warn of restricted roads and low bridges. In Durham, North Carolina, we saw it firsthand. Truck after truck, more than 100 since 2008, slamming into a low-profile bridge they call the can opener. In Texas today, police say the garbage truck driver drove right underneath these dangling tubes that serve as a warning.
There's a huge sign that says if you hit this, you are going to hit the bridge. And the folks behind the truck, they saw it hit it.
Tonight, Texas authorities have opened a homicide investigation. Tom Costello, NBC News, Washington.
Still ahead tonight, what every parent needs to know about preventing cancer in their kids. A troubling rise in types of the disease preventable by what some doctors say should be a back-to-school vaccine. Also, disco fever, the woman who's kept the party going across the nation for nearly five decades. Back now with the alarming news from the CDC. The numbers of cancers related to the HPV virus have dramatically increased, including cancers of the cervix, head, and neck. But health officials say these cancers can be prevented with a vaccine given to preteens. NBC's Ann Thompson now with more on a new call from doctors to get kids vaccinated.
Linda Ryan is battling cancer again. This mom's third bout with cervical cancer, linked to HPV.
If I had had the vaccination, I wouldn't be going through what I'm going through now.
Today's report from the CDC says that the number of HPV cancers increased to almost 39,000 a year from 2008 to 2012, a 17% jump. And it says HPV vaccines could have prevented the vast majority. HPV is the most common sexually transmitted disease in the U.S., one reason many parents have resisted vaccinating their children.
The goal of the HPV vaccine is to give it before the kid is exposed, long before you're probably even having some of those discussions that they're worried about.
Routine vaccination is recommended at 11 or 12 years because it only works if it takes place before the boy or girl is sexually active. The vaccines are given in three doses over 6 months, yet only 40% of girls and 21% of boys get all three shots.
The connection between HPV and cancer is much stronger than the connection between smoking and lung cancer. And so we really need to take advantage of this underused vaccine.
Leading cancer center MD Anderson is now on a campaign to raise awareness with help from Linda Ryan. She's had both her teenage sons vaccinated.
I don't know how you cannot prevent your child from getting cancer if there's a way to do it.
Trying to remove the stigma from a life-saving vaccine. Ann Thompson, NBC News, New York.
We're back in a moment with the latest on a huge Mega Millions jackpot. No matter who Britain's next prime minister is, one thing for certain, it will be a woman. The race to succeed David Cameron, who is resigning after the recent Brexit vote, is down to two women, Theresa May and Andrea Leadsom. Whoever wins will be the UK's first female prime minister since Margaret Thatcher left office in 1990. Lottery fever is sweeping this country tonight. The jackpot for tomorrow's Mega Millions drawing has gone up to $540 million. The game is played in 44 states, and the odds of winning, roughly one in 259 million. The annual running of the bulls kicked off today in Spain. For the next week, bulls will be released in the streets of Pamplona each day. Visitors come from around the world to run with them, hoping to keep one step ahead of the horns, although two or three steps ahead wouldn't be bad. At least four people were injured in the first run today. No one, however, was gored. When we come back, we'll tell you why this woman is the undisputed queen of disco. They are a sparkling symbol of an age gone by, a time when disco was king. Although the music itself has enjoyed a revival, the disco ball is almost gone, at least those made in this country. Almost gone. Cynthia McFadden tonight on A Woman Still Feeling the Beat.
No one owes more to the disco ball than John Travolta. That is, no one besides Yolanda Yo-Yo Baker.
You're the queen of the disco balls. That's what they tell me.
For 48 years now, Yo-Yo's been building the iconic balls in Louisville, Kentucky, at the only company still making them in the United States. Back in the heyday, she was one of more than two dozen folks working at Omega National Products, turning out thousands of disco balls every week. They made the one in Saturday Night Fever and the one for Soul Train.
This place must have been rocking.
It was. We had music going all the time.
In fact, if you've ever danced, skated, or fallen in love under a disco ball in the past 50 years, it was probably one of theirs. But the glory days have faded, and today, Yo-Yo is the last of her kind, making just 4 to 5 balls a week. Because while one of hers goes for $125, the Chinese can sell theirs for just $30.
They don't make very good balls. I don't know why anybody would buy them one.
Open the door there, Nathan.
Oh, my goodness.
But the people of Louisville aren't giving up without a fight, hiring another local company to build this 11-foot ball to celebrate their disco past. And now they're trying to raise $1 million to build an even bigger one, a 7-story ball to steal the world record away from Great Britain. But Yo-Yo may have a better idea for recapturing the magic.
So you have a bone to pick with John Travolta.
It's his fault.
It's John Travolta's fault?
He quit.
So should we send a message to John Travolta?
Good idea. Get off your butt and dance again.
Looks like the disco ball's in your court, Mr. Travolta. Cynthia McFadden, NBC News, Louisville, Kentucky.
That's going to do it for us on a Thursday night. I'm Lester Holt. For all of us at NBC News, thank you for watching, and good night.